The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 4 of this 7-day sesshin at Mountain Gate, and the sun has come out after several days of rain, which was blessed. We now have the sun again, and the combination is pretty terrific. However, it was getting to be quite the mud pie around here, and so it's nice to have it a little bit drier. It was optimal timing that we fertilized the fruit trees just before the rain began, and that we had several days of rain afterwards. So this is Mother Nature smiling upon us indeed. And today I would like to continue with a selection from Hawkwind's writings, Poison Blossoms from a Thicket of Thorn, translated by Norman Waddell. This is a new translation, first-time translation of this huge volume of material that was, it's said, published by Hawkwind himself, and he used it after that to lecture from, commenting on his own comments. This piece that I'm going to share today happens to be a commentary of his on a, it's actually a capping phrase, and that came out of a passage in the Record of Rinzai, Record of Linchi, and the quote by Rinzai appears to be, "Followers of the way, make no mistake, when the Asuras fight against the god Indra and are defeated in battle, they lead their host of 84,000 followers, and all of them hide in a hollow filament of a lotus. Is that not miraculous?" And the Asuras are the fighting demons of Buddhist lore. And the god Indra, it's kind of odd that he comes into Buddhism, but he has been co-opted. He's a good guy. The Asuras, of course, are the fighting demons. They're the bad guys. And the good guy defeats the bad guys. And then the bad guys hide inside lotus threads, which is an infinitely small space. There's a note about them. Lotus threads are very fine, delicate filaments produced from viscous fluid that exudes from the root of the lotus plant when it is cut. These filaments are dried and woven into a cloth that was used for garments and as canvas for religious paintings. They appear in Buddhist literature as a metaphor for something extremely small and fine. And so here is what Hawkwind has to say about this. And it relates to our own practice, actually, because it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for the kinds of things that can come up in our mind while we are trying to deepen our practice. Zen Master Linchi said, "When the Asuras fought against the god Indra and were defeated in battle, they led their host of 84,000 followers and hid together with them in a hollow lotus filament. Indra, unable to attack them there, withdrew." His words are based on a passage in the Flower Garland Sutra. And Hawkwind continues, "I always found it strange that after their defeat, the Asuras chose to conceal themselves inside a lotus filament. Asuras possess extraordinary supernatural powers. They could have easily crowded their evil host of 84,000 inside an infinitely smaller space, in the eye of a bite that makes its nest in the eyebrow of a mosquito, for example, in a mosquito's nose, in a mote of dust, or on the tip of a needle. Why did they choose a lotus filament as a place of concealment? On achieving victory over the Asuras, Indra and the four guardian gods under his command would have moved with the fleetness of the wind. In no time at all, they would have searched the lotus ponds, found the lotus stalks, and extracted the lotus filaments. The Asura forces would have little hope of escaping them. Even if they were able to hide, Indra and the other gods, who all possess the heavenly eye, which takes in at a single glance all existence without exception, as though gazing at a crystal in the palm of the hand. They would have immediately discovered this, the Asura forces. If it was winter or early spring, when the buds had not yet appeared on the lotus roots and everything is bare, they would have apprehended them with even greater ease. My doubts about this remained with me for many years. Then recently, while I was doing Zazen, it all suddenly became clear to me. Elated, I've written down here what I discovered for some of my Zen students. It is a subtle example of the manner in which sutras employ metaphor, and I think it can be of great use to someone engaged in practicing the way. Let me now try to explain it for you. Suppose a superior religious seeker engaged in practicing the way continues to sit quietly with his backbone perfectly straight until body and mind disappear and he becomes one with all things. As tranquil as a perfectly clear body of water or a portion of the vast empty sky. If even a slight flicker of thought arises, though, the firmament fills with cloud and fog, waves swell up that can swallow ranges upon ranges of towering peaks, valleys and mountains howl in raging fury, noise and vapors spit forth, ice and hail and lightning and thunder dart from the head, deadly encompassing clouds. When we are sitting Zazen, if we've been able to quiet our mind, we get to a place of deep quiet, and this is something that someone who's practiced Zen for a while can accomplish, and then if we have just the slightest little bit of thought that comes up and we turn towards it and begin to engage with it, then it's like all hell breaks loose. Where did our quiet, deep, tranquil mind state disappear to? Now we have a choice here. We can fight, struggle to bring the mind back down to just the work of the practice, whether it's a koan or whether it's the extended out breath or a combination. Or we can do something else. We can recognize that this stuff has come up, tune in, feel it, and allow ourselves to drift down deep into the bottom of the ocean, below the towering waves, below all the ruckus, below all the stirred up stuff. And Hakuin addresses this to a certain degree. He says, such circumstances as these describe the time when the Asuras, enjoying a great victory, reveal the immensity of their bodies, making vast oceans seem shallow, boundless skies seem narrow, and they shake the sacred halls and pavilions with their horrendous roaring. The human mind quails before this. Even the cinnabar field may break and crumble. That's the center of our being. This describes what he had mentioned in the previous paragraph about the oceans rising up and swallowing the towering peaks and hail and ice being spit out all over and all the rest of the commotion. But if at such a time the student bores into his koan or concentrates single-mindedly on his own original self, then everything, the ocean of the Dharmakaya and the fundamental source of his own mind, will suddenly become calm and tranquil, just as when a great dipper of cold water is poured into a seething cauldron. This is descriptive of the conditions that prevailed when Indra achieved his great victory. Each of the four guardian gods has now secured his position. The other heavenly deities are rejoicing and congratulating each other. In the Dharma Hall, each of the mani gems in Indra's net is reflecting a million other mani gems, endlessly manifesting a realm where all phenomenal existences in an ever-changing lord and vassal relation are interfused while at the same time remaining mutually unhindered. At such a time, the devil legions, 84,000 strong, without a single place to hide, vanish without leaving a single trace behind. No matter where you search in any of the 10 directions, no matter what means you use, you cannot discover a single one. So we have been sitting, and we have enough experience in our sitting that we've been able to quiet the mind. And we're going deeper and deeper within, more and more quietly, more and more aware. And then this flicker of thought comes up. And if we're not careful, we go chasing it, either to try to bat it out of the universe, or because it's so enticing, we can't help but following. It's at that time when it's especially important to recommit to the practice. There's no point in fighting, because when we fight these thoughts and mind states, it just makes them stronger. As was said before, the important thing to do is to recommit to the practice, give ourselves ever more completely to the out-breath, take it far out, farther than you can imagine, and then do it again, and then do it again, and then do it again, and eventually all the ruckus will die down, and you'll go back, you will be back in a much more quiet and deep mind state. Chew on the koan more completely. Who am I? Who am I? Really? I can't trust my thoughts. Where did I come from before I was born? I didn't just pop into this body. Or did I? What happens to me when I die? Where will I go? Or will I go? Or will it all go black, like somebody turned out the lights? What will happen? What will happen? We don't try to push out the difficult mind state. We acknowledge that it appears to be there, and in that moment of an acknowledgement, we go right back into the practice. This is very, very important in terms of keeping our practice on track and working with these challenging mind states that can come unbidden, suddenly, out of nowhere. Things are going very well, and then suddenly, just one little thought, and all of a sudden we're flooded. It's vital at that point, pull our mind back to the practice. However, as Hawkwind continues, at this point the practicer is waltzing about in a rapture of delight, thinking everything has now been settled. But he must wait, for he's unaware that those devil legions are at that very moment insinuating their way into those subtle thoughts of joy, and will lie waiting hidden inside them. What do I mean by subtle thoughts of joy? Minute flows of delusive thought that are difficult to completely cut off and are constantly trickling out like water from the eighth consciousness. Is this not the meaning of those hosts of afflicting demons, delusive thoughts that are difficult to cut off, concealing themselves inside a lotus root? Once they've insinuated themselves with great subtlety into the holes in the lotus root, where it's impossible to attack them, one has no recourse but to retreat. Yang Shan asked Kuei Shan, those subtle flowings from the mind, how many years since you've been rid of them? 7 years, replied Kuei Shan. This too refers to rooting out the devil hosts hidden inside the hollow filaments of the lotus root. How do you accomplish it? The patriarchal teachers contrived an expedient device for severing, as if with a fine sword, the fundamental source of delusive thoughts. It is far more effective than trying to smash the thoughts themselves, even if you took a 10,000-ton hammer to them. A monk asked Joshu, "Does a dog have the Buddha nature or not?" Joshu said, "Moo. If you concentrate on this koan, you will find that it has extraordinary efficacy. If you really want to attain a realm of peace and repose, you should work on this koan." And this must be something that Hak Wing said before he took to favoring the sound of one hand as the koan over the sound of Mu. If you continue attacking it from the top, from the bottom, and from every other possible angle, and you suddenly die the great death and are born anew, you will find that you will blush as you recall all these stories. Strive hard. Do it now. Don't wait until you've grown old and find tears running down your withered cheeks. Then it will be too late. It is my sincerest hope that you will succeed. He talks about attacking it from the top, from the bottom, and from every possible angle. Hawkwind's personality was such that attacking is the word he would use. But sometimes attacking just blows things out of the water and doesn't really get rid of them and doesn't really do anything but shove them under the carpet. More effective, at least for Westerners, is this: when things come up, when we're working deeply on our koan, when we're working on tracing down, following the tenuous thread of this yearning to become free, we want to become inwardly deeply quiet so that we can hear, so that we can become aware of the truth when it presents itself to us. It's not about attacking anything that comes up. If things come up, if they're really strong, then simply to accept, radical acceptance, that this seems to be how things appear at the moment, and then immediately turn and dive more deeply with greater commitment into your practice, whatever your practice is. Chew on that practice like it's your lifeline, because in a very real way it is. Chew on it, even if it's dry as a bone. Don't shift your practice when it becomes dry. This is very, very important. The practice is about bringing us through every mind state in a mindset that isn't moved around by whatever mind state might appear. And so we get a practice when these different challenging mind states come up, whether we're solidly bored, whether we're frustrated, whether our practice seems to have gone on vacation, a long vacation, whether we seem to be assailed by the demon hordes. It doesn't matter what the mind state is. Allow yourself to open to the experience. Don't try to shut it down. That only makes it stronger. Open to the experience, and in the midst of it, be curious. Who is it that feels this? Who is it that thinks this? Where is this experience coming from? And the yearning, even if it's gone underground, be curious.
curious. Don't take anything for granted. Dive deep into this exploration of your own mind so completely that there's no one exploring. And that's why, that's when awakening can come forth. Give it your best shot. It'll be over and over and over again. You'll run the gamut of everything your mind can produce, hoping to entice you away from this search. And don't assume that if you're in a difficult mind state, that it's a disaster. It may not be. You may be right on the edge of opening to something much deeper. And don't get confident if the mind seems to be deeply quiet. It's another way of stepping out very subtly, as Hawkwind has mentioned. Even in this quiet joy that the demon hordes are finally vanquished, they are silently creeping back into the joy. And before you know it, you'll be pulled off, far off the practice by that mind state. Don't trust any of it. It's the weather moving through. Where did it come from? Who is feeling it? Who's aware of it? Where is that one? Show me evidence of that one. In this way, you can take your practice very, very deep. Trust that the practice will work. Be aware of stepping outside it, even in the most subtle ways, like feeling good about that calm mind state. Don't take anything for granted. Dive deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, even if your lungs are bursting. Dive. Think about those pearl fisherwomen in Japan who dive 150 feet without oxygen, without scuba gear. They just dive, searching for that pearl in the midst of all that's on the bottom of the ocean. And that pearl is within your sight. Go for it. Thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.